gifts. Good morning, Father, Son. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hello, this is Caroline Wise King, your host, welcoming you to Shaman's Keep. Thank you for joining me today. I have a wonderful guest for you, someone that gives us a whole new perspective on shamanism. Her name is Dr. Olga Karatidi Yahantova. She was born and raised in Russia during the Cold War period and studied shamanism and the native traditions during a time when it was prohibited in the Soviet Union. So she has written a book called Enter the Circle, which is a fascinating look at Siberian shamanism as practiced in the Altai Mountains. And she is currently in the United States. She works as a forensic psychiatrist working in a maximum security hospital. So I'm sure she has some very interesting views on mind and spirit and how people function and think and respond and feel about life. So, Olga, thank you for joining us on Shaman's Keep today.
Well, thank you so much. Hello, Caroline, and thank you for a wonderful introduction. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show because this is a completely different look at shamanism. I try and have shamans from many different countries on and give us a glimpse of what shamanism is like, how it's practiced there. But first, would you tell us a little bit about your background growing up in Russia and working in a psychiatric hospital there?
I'll try. It's been so long ago, but it definitely is the fundamental background for sure. And the more experiences I gain through life, the more grateful I become to that particular environment where I grew up, where everything was constricted and didn't seem to be so exciting, but at the same time provided huge resources for inner growth, including the environment of living next to different cultures, being able to travel in Siberia, in Central Asia. So I now cherish those experiences. I did grow up in Siberia. I graduated medical school there, became a psychiatrist. I practiced traditional psychiatry in Siberian hospital, quite similar to what I do right now, ironically, in the United States, with different level, of course, of medicine years later, but still a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. And studied native cultures, studied... you said it very nicely, understanding human emotions, feelings, my own, first of all, my patients, to be able to heal, to transform, to grow. So I studied everything that I could find, and I was very lucky to be able to have direct contact with traditional cultures, Siberian cultures, shamanic cultures. And at that time, everything spiritual was prohibited, basically. So everything was incredibly desirable, as you can imagine. The more you prohibit something, the more people would try to get it. And we were lucky to have group of people, group of friends that we traveled together, did expeditions together. Mm. And I did write a book about it, but it's only a little, you know, layer of the surface of what was going on at that time. Mm. And it's a very rich background. Like I said, I'm very grateful for that. And I can talk for the whole hour about it, but maybe we should just move to something else.
Well, I really enjoyed your descriptions in entering the circle of your experiences living there during a time that was very restrictive and where certain things were prohibited. But like you say, all you have to do is say something is forbidden, and that's the very thing that people want to do, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
right.
Yes. So having raised children, I know.
Well,
firsthand,
there you go.
All you have to do mm-hmm. is say, no, you don't do that. You don't touch that. And mm-hmm. right away, they're finding a way to do it. So I've always been interested in the Altai. Is that how you say it? Mountains?
Right.
That area?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I seem to have some kind of, I don't know, maybe it's a past lifetime or something. But and I've never been there. But I can visualize it, and I worked with a young woman once that was from there, and she had this wonderful book with all the beautiful pictures. It's a magnificent area, and mm-hmm. shamanism is still a very viable practice there, isn't it? It's still
in the way,
being used
in the way
quite a bit.
It is resurrecting. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Yes. There are cycles. There are cycles of development, I see, like and everything else. And this is a tradition that is being resurrected on a different level. It's almost like Michael Harney's vision is being implemented. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much he is part of that. I know there was some projects. When I met Michael Harney years ago in California, when I just came into this country, they were talking about trying to help, actually, traditional culture in Siberia and Altai specifically.
Yes.
To restore shamanism. And I don't know if it happened or not in practical real life, but I know it kind of happened in ideal dimension where those ideas started to become reality. Of course, with intention and work of people on the ground, native people. So I doubt that it's the same practice as it used to be in past centuries, because everything evolves. But basic principles that involve human nature, human mind, they are still the same. And they, by the way, are the same in many, many different cultures, because we are all the same human beings. We have similar
yes.
nature, regardless of our culture. And the shamanism, as far as I know, and I've studied a lot of different traditions and ways, but shamanism is the most efficient in terms of utilizing knowledge about human mind and being practical and being very utilitarian in a way how they use those principles for change.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, this is one of the most advanced technologies that I've ever encountered in terms of therapy, in terms of understanding prediction of how change evolves, transformation. It's still, in my view, unsurpassed system that understands human mm-hmm. mind better than anything. So I can't tell you what's going on there right now. I haven't been there for a long time. I'm sure mm-hmm. there are many people right now going back and forth. I have a wonderful group of colleagues and students in Europe who go there quite often, and there's a lot of exchange right now and a lot of information coming out of Altai, which is very nice to see. It's a very different situation now that compared to when I first was writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, the practices are somewhat different. For instance, I did study with the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, and mm-hmm. Michael Harner taught me the first basic method of studying, to go to the other side and meet your power animals and meet your teacher and mm-hmm. learn to work with them. And it was wonderful. But I noticed that a lot of what they were doing in the Altai was not so much journeying like we do, or like I do, as taught by the foundation. And it was, you call it dreaming. Do they use any psychedelics or anything, drugs over there?
Well, all shamanic cultures use psychedelics, for sure.
No, right. Not
and
all
I think
of them.
I wrote about it. There's nothing, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, there was just some interruption
okay.
here.
Okay.
There's different means to enhance altered perception, and substances is just one part of that. Different type of trance-inducing activities like excessive dancing, specific meditations. It's all widely practiced in Asian shamanism altogether. I think what is radically different from what I know how it's practiced by modern people in our culture is the structure, because shamans, they don't have the same structure, the same manual, so to speak, or, you know, strategy. We do first step, we drum, then we close our eyes, then we count, then we go there. It's much more chaotic for our perception, but it's very congruent to their lifestyle, because their lifestyle in general is just very, very differently structured than our lifestyle, including their whole identity. And I think that's why I always believe that we can just simply translate it, because they're two different universes. And that's why I never called myself shaman. I've done a lot of practices and things and experiences that they do, because I'm a very practical person. I jump into anything that can give me new experience, and I've done it, you know, relentlessly. And even some shamans told me that I am a shaman. I never said it myself, because I do realize that I belong to different culture and my cultural roots are different. My mind is already conditioned differently. So I gratefully use and apply the knowledge from that culture, but still, I think there's a lot of differences that, you know, in practice of shamanism that comes from the whole lifestyle and culture.
Well, I've noticed, well, of course, in a tribal community, they recognize the qualities in a child that would help them develop to be a shaman, and they begin training them as children. In our society, we don't have anything like that, but I have found that most people that do become active in shamanism had abilities from the time they were a child. I mean, when I was 4 years old, I saw my first deceased person. It was actually my father, who had died when I was two, and he appeared to me in the living room and was smiling at me, and I was very excited that he was home. It wasn't that exciting to my mother, but it was the beginning of me being able to communicate with beings on the other side. And so I suppose, you know, in shamanism, we understand that we're aware that there are other energies, entities, and spirits all around us that
but
are not visible
Caroline,
to the human eye.
If I may something about this experience, it's very interesting that you shared this. Thank you. Because it's very fascinating for me to hear how you having this experience that many people do have. And as a psychiatrist working with people for ages now, you know, I know firsthand that people internally experience a lot of things, more so than we believe, than we share publicly. And it's interesting that you were able to find some legitimate system where you can discuss those experiences and find some context and meaning for them in a completely separate culture. So shaman, it's okay to say it as a shaman, right, that you had those experiences. And it's not exactly okay to say it like your mother didn't appreciate it. In our modern culture, you know, European culture and American culture, it's not that accepted yet to talk about those things. And I think it's incredibly important, because this is where the key to our healing lies, because I think that's what I would like to see personally, to change, to take that stigma away and make people in general more comfortable with exploring, sharing, talking about experiences that kids have a lot, and being able to nurture those experiences and give them some meaning and actually teach them how to use that, so people don't get scared, afraid, and start thinking that I must be insane. I've worked with so many people who repressed those experiences and were terrified to mention it until they either come to, a lot of times they come to my seminars, my workshops, and we start talking and we start working practically, and they open up about it. And sometimes those energies come back after years of repression, and there's so much power and so much healing and joy, actually, because it's part of us. So it's very interesting you said it. Fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Well, the reason I said my mother wasn't excited about it, it was strange, because in my family it was considered that certain things had there were omens and there were things to be aware of and everything. Like, well, I won't even go into that now, but when I saw
it's true. It's true. There's a lot of superstition as well. Whereas the repression, there's inevitably superstition because it is a part of life. It is a part of our experience as humans because death is essential part of our transformation, but because we are conditioned to avoid it and not talk about it, it stays somewhere in the dark dungeon and then brings out a lot of different things that create all superstitions and other phenomena, but it's not knowledge. It's not, you know, really true great experience that we can have with that awareness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true because it has been repressed by the churches and by doctors even who say that, you know, if you're hearing voices or seeing things that aren't there, then probably you're mentally ill or you're possessed.
Right, and I wouldn't go into that discussion because I'm one of those doctors. But I mean, both things are true. Both things are true, and a lot of times I get a lot of letters actually from people asking me to help out to sort it out and differentiate whether it's mental illness and whether it's some sign of repressed power. And you know, there is mental illness. There is situations when people do experience all that, and it's a sign of, you know, destruction and disorganization of the mind that has nothing to do this power that is treatable. But we know about mental illness, but we do not know about power yet.
Mm. Yes, we're learning. Okay.
Right.
Well,
right.
Well, now that we're talking about that part of it, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. As I was talking earlier, we're aware that we have guides and spirits around us and everything. But I've worked with a number of people over the years who were drug addicts or alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that drug use and excessive alcohol consumption seems to open them to it leaves their energetic body unprotected, and it opens them to entities and spirits that can enter in them and everything. And because I noticed that it seems to go hand in hand with drugs and alcohol, I wondered if the heavy sedation and medications you give a mental patient might also make them vulnerable to negative entities attaching to them or entering them.
Well, to answer your question, first I need to say a little bit about the whole context, because you bring out the philosophy of negative spirits and the possession and opening to that possession, which in general I may say I do share, but not exactly like that. So it's much more complex than that. And anything can be a gate for negative influence, anything. It can be medications, not just psychiatric medications, any experience, any food, anything that mind finds particularly, you know, sensitive to. Drugs and alcohol, I don't think they per se can be that, you know, negative gate for possessive spirits, as you said that. If more than anything, a lot of times it is self-medication. A lot of cases with chronic addiction, it's just extended self-medication. So in my practice, my first question would be, what is the person trying to self-medicate? So, and the core usually goes way deeper and earlier than any addiction ever started.
Oh, of course.
So I have never met somebody who was perfectly balanced, happy, who suddenly got addicted and then became open to some destructive spirit.
Oh,
there may be cases like that, but I have not seen it. I've seen people who are suffering and struggling and hurting, and then they try to find something available. And there's a lot available out there on the streets that people find just to soothe their pain. That's how I see it. But yes, by itself, I think it does have already such a collective presence. A lot of drugs, they have their own spirit, so to speak. This is shamanic view I share deeply, that everything is alive, everything has its own spirit, any system, any being. So in that case, any substance that is acting collectively in numbing down a lot of people has already its own collective presence, its own spirit, and it's not, you know, beneficial for people. It's quite malignant. Right.
Yes.
That does make sense?
Well, Oh, absolutely. Because when I work with people with those problems, usually what they need is a soul retrieval because something traumatic happened to them in their past, either in this lifetime or a past lifetime, that is causing them to need to escape into something like drugs or alcohol. And the soul retrieval is amazing. I mean, I've seen miracles happen with people. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But so you're right, absolutely, that it started from their need, something that's caused them to need to self-medicate. And so, yes, that's very interesting. Well, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about writing your book, Entering the Circle.
Oh, well, I don't remember any of that anymore.
Oh, it's not that long ago.
Well, you know, it's ages in my universe. In general, I must say, it's probably writing in general. It applies to every book I wrote. And I wrote Master of Lucid Dreams after that. And I wrote Michael Gate right now. That took me 7 years. So all those experiences were similar in a way that I try to resist it. I try not to do it. I try not to promote it. And every time I was almost forced by circumstances to continue doing that until just recently with this new book, I finally discovered the immense joy of writing. And I understood it as very much kind of a trance. Like I said, it is a very shamanic experience for me to write. It became so. With Entering the Circle, it was more fighting. It's almost like becoming a shaman through writing. If I said I was a shaman, that would be my path of initiation, writing my books. So the very first one was the most difficult one in that case because I was struggling. I didn't want to make it public. It was my diaries that I took and turned into a story that was readable for people. And I didn't have any expectations. I just went with that, and it was very successful. It helped me to connect with so many people, basically in different countries, and it's still a foundation for my connection with a lot of people. I'm very grateful for that. But at the same time, maybe because I struggled, I never really had a feeling that I wrote a book, I'm a writer. I never had that piece of identity that even had any pride or any ownership of that. I just feel I'm attached to that book, that experience, we are together, and it has a life of its own, and I have some responsibilities to that, and it helps me too. Especially like second book, Master of Lucid Dreams, it helps me with my healing when I didn't even remember what exactly I wrote it, but when I was going through my trauma 8 years ago, a friend of mine actually advised me, why don't you just use the technique that you offered in your own book? And I didn't remember about it, and I did, and it worked like a miracle. So it's a constant connection with these entities that they become mm-hmm. my books, and that's how I feel about it. But it's very much altered state of consciousness and exploration of different creative modalities. I mean, I can say a lot of words about it, but it's very different from anything else, and I'm very grateful for that experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting because Entering the Circle, I thought, was a great book.
Thank you.
You did make it clear, though, all the way through it, just about that you were really struggling with the whole shamanic idea that you know, this was so foreign compared to what you know about the mind and working as a psychiatrist. And you were very reluctant to accept a lot of the ideas that you couldn't really fight against because you saw them happening and experienced right. them with your own eyes and everything. But you struggled to accept a lot of that. And I see that you are still in a sense struggling against shamanism, although you know it has great power.
No. Let me say that I don't struggle against shamanism at all. It's probably part of my personality. And again, you know, where I'm working right now, I work with criminally insane.
Yes.
I have already this solid personality that is constantly at war to some extent, you know. Mm. But I want to be very clear that it's a very much integral part of my experience, my philosophy, my worldview. And I see, like I said, it's the most advanced system that I know in terms of understanding human nature practically. I mean, there's a lot of theoretical, beautiful spiritual religious systems. They talk about it in beautiful terms. Shamanism doesn't have a lot of written accounts, but it has immense body of practice. And that body of practice, I think it's incomparable to anything else in its efficiency. So I don't struggle with that at all. I accept it fully. And I think I'm a very practical person. Whenever I see something working, I'm going to accept that. And I will adjust my concepts immediately to something that works, because I found concepts are very, very flexible. I don't hold much value in any conceptual thinking at this point, because I know I can produce millions of them, you know, in a minute. I mean, maybe not millions in a minute, but a lot. And they can be of any value, but what is most valuable is our feelings, our experience. And when I see something so profoundly affecting us and giving us a new way of experiencing ourselves in this lifetime, that is the most valuable for me. And shamanism is a primary system that delivers us there. So
it certainly does. It's time tested, because, you know, they have found, archaeologists have found things that were used by shaman in digs that date back 40,000 years, and it probably dates back even farther than that. But they have shown proof of you know, tools and things that shamans use that go back 40,000 years. So that's a lot of history and a lot of time-tested work that's gone into shamanism, and it really does work. It's just amazing to me.
Exactly.
I'm really curious. I haven't read the book, The Master of Lucid Dreaming, but I am interested in that, because sometimes doing journey work, which is like lucid dreaming, because you are in an alternate reality. And I was wondering, I know you became very curious about all of these things, and you've researched all of this a lot. So tell us a little bit about lucid dreaming and about why you wrote that book.
It's not exactly about lucid dreaming. So in a way, the title is maybe a little bit misleading, but there was something about it. It's more about, it was, again, my personal journey. It was the account of something that I had experienced personally that I put into narrative. Those first two books, they were more like a storytelling that I used as a therapy tool. I wanted to share stories with people that can be helpful for them in their journey. And it's account of my experiences that is condensed and just made in a narrative that is easy to follow, with some things are kind of being cut out of the narrative, because the reality, of course, is much more rich than actual, you know, writing. So in that sense, those two books are just basically storytelling. The one that I have right now, it's a whole different game, and I'd like to talk about it, because I'm very excited about it myself. But I will try to focus on your question. And in a way, it's not specifically lucid dreaming, so I don't want to be misleading. It's not going to give you any tools or teachings how to do lucid dreaming. But what it does, it again talks about that there is another reality. There is an invisible reality in addition to what we experience with our senses. There is other presences, other lives and experiences that we have outside of the scope of our rational awareness. And this is what I'm writing about. And there are ways to enter that. There are ways to experience that and expand our consciousness. So in that sense, that's what about it. And it's about Central Asian tradition that I was lucky to experience in Uzbekistan, that was open at the time I traveled there. And it's a remarkable place, this remarkable culture that's not so open at this time, at least for me it's not. But we were very lucky to get there and travel extensively. So, and it's a personal story. All my stories are highly personal, because that's what I feel the most. And I share my feelings, and hopefully people can relate to that and gain something for their own experiences.
Oh, yes. That's the best kind of writing, because you lived it, and you could sense it and smell it and see it and hear it and feel it and all. So you do convey that in your writing. I find your writing delightful. So thank you. I am very interested in this new book that you have out, Michael Gate is the name of it, and it is available on Amazon on a for Kindle only at this time.
It's a limited edition, right? It's electronic version for Amazon Kindle only, and that's done on purpose at this time because it's very. I don't advertise it. I don't promote it yet. And you somehow, you need to tell me how you, of all people, just this perfect timing, asked me for this interview without knowing about this book, because it's been under wraps and it's going to be until probably another month or so, because I just make it available for people who know my work, who work with me, and I'm working specifically on creating how I'm going to present and promote it, because I see it as a very different vehicle that I want to be very responsible when I bring it more widely to the world. But you found, you didn't know about it, but you just, you know, decided to ask me to join you for this conversation. How did you do that? What prompted you to find me?
Because I'm guided by my shamanic guides, and it was like I was looked up at my books of all my books, on my library, all the stuff about shamanism, and your book caught my eye. I hadn't looked at it in a while. It's been, because I've had this book, gosh, maybe 10 years, I don't know.
Right.
And it suddenly, like, jumped out at me, and I pulled it down, and it was like, I need to get her on this show. And
isn't
so
it amazing?
Immediately, but you have to understand, Olga, that you are being guided by your shamanic guides also. That's who guided you to write Entering the Circle and the Master of Lucid Dreaming.
Well,
and
I
all
do understand that, Caroline. Of course I do understand that, but thank you for reminding me. No, it's just amazing to see this magic in action, so to speak, because
it is
a wonderful synchronicity, and that's how it's working. And I got a few other invitations right now. First time in 8 years I'm doing something publicly. Frankly, I have been lucky because people do remember me, especially in Europe, and people have been inviting me to do different things. And I don't do any public work at all. I've been focusing on my work as a psychiatrist and writing. In the last 7 years, I've been writing this new book. And even though I enjoy different, you know, public events and working with people, like being on your show, it's really a pleasure. I enjoy it very much right now. But I have been quite reclusive for the last 8 years. So this is the first interview I'm doing in 8 years. And I thank you for that. And again, it's really amazing how the magic works.
Oh,
and
yes.
Again, it leaves me very little opportunity not to do that.
This
is okay. And I'm okay with that.
You know, we are never alone.
Well, that's very true. That's very true.
Yeah.
So if I have a moment right now, if I can tell you a little bit about Michael Gate, because, like I said, I'm very excited about it, and I think you will find it interesting, and hopefully the audience will find it interesting, because when I wrote the first two books, I got so many letters from people who wanted to experience something like I did in their own way. And probably one of the most predominant requests, in addition to healing requests that I get, was, can I go to the same places? Can you give me, you know, names? Can you give me some direction? And I wish I could, but realistically, you can't rationally make a decision like that and go and jump into experience of magic. And I know that people who have that in the desire, they do encounter that regardless, and I trust that. But at the same time, I've been thinking, okay, what can I do as a creative person, as a writer at this point? What can I do to actually give people the experience of magic as fully as possible, as if it was 3D writing, so to speak? And this is what I did. This book is basically an experiment. That's why I'm so I'm making steps trying to bring it out, because I don't see it just a piece of fiction. It's a fictional account. I call it transformational fiction. And it's a story about Michael Gate, who's a main character, who's a forensic psychiatrist, who lives a double life. And he exists in the dimension of our culture as a very prominent forensic psychiatrist working with criminally insane. And I have a lot of material, of course, to supply Michael with his day duties. And then he exists in another reality as an animal, and he is in denial. As a modern rational person, he's in complete denial of that other part of himself. And
oh,
that
I love
part
it.
That part is in love with the goddess. And there's this whole other dimension, the whole other universe of gods and goddesses and spirits where he exists, but when he comes back from those episodes, he forgets. And that causes so much suffering for him. And then he encounters, and it's a crime fiction and it's a love story. It's, I think it's a very entertaining story because it's paced now, and it took 7 years to craft it, basically. It's his story of breaking his denial, trying to resolve this forensic case, trying to do what he feels right in his soul. It was my survival. First, it was my survival because I had severe trauma 8 years ago. And it's also a very personal book. It's based, it's a fictional account, but all the feelings that in this book, they are all real. And when I did it, and finished that, when his denial was basically broken and he came to full realization of his expanded universe, same happened to me. And my reality was expanded to the point that I never expected, and it was the most amazing transformation I've ever encountered. And since then, I've been living in a different universe myself. It's a new cosmology, it's a new universe, it's a new foundation for everything I understand about myself and life and death and everything. And after that happened, I realized that what I created, it was a transformative text that works objectively, basically, by itself, because the way it was created through my own transformation. And after that, I worked on it already as a writer, as a creative writer, and I put it as a structure that can hopefully, and it does, as I can see, it does, can work on its own. So basically, what happens when people read it, it fosters the experience in a way that people may get in touch with their own repressed feelings, that thinks that they are in denial, and they can experience transformation that is as profound and as magical as they would want to. And it's working. I see it's working, and that's why I'm trying to find a way, how do I need to present it to people, so even though it's very entertaining fictional novel that is very easy to read, but I want to be responsible and I want to present it to people so they understand what they actually are taking. But this is the journeying, shamanic journeying with characters, with that universe of the book, as much as I know in terms of literature, in terms of going into the 3D, three-dimensional world of characters and experiencing it for yourself and actually experiencing something in yourself after that. And that's the beginning. It's going to be a whole series. Like I said, they have life of its own, those books, and this one is particular, maybe because it's new. This is so active, and I have no chance to live in peace for next, I don't know, many years probably, because after he experiences his revelation, the character, he becomes a psychiatrist for people. He starts working in private practice, Michael. He works on different cases from that perspective as an animal living in a different kingdom and as a forensic psychiatrist. And when he heals people from that perspective, I know that it will be the whole series of books that people can read and say, okay, let's say I have problems in relationships and I can't understand why can I find, you know, a person that would feed my needs or be my partner or something like that. I work with couples counseling as well. And things stem from experiences far beyond our individual life sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not just even enough to do soul retrieval, as you call it, in this lifetime. It involves much broader perspective. People have problems. Any personal, private problem that people have, I think it's going to be serious that we'll address it, but from that perspective. And I'm quite excited about it. I think it's going to be interesting. And I don't even know what he's going to do, because this whole book was a movie that I saw in front of my eyes. I didn't expect it to be this way. I didn't know what was going to happen. And one of the major revelations that comes at the very end, I didn't know it until it happened. I wrote the book, I tried to finish it, and one of the characters, he wouldn't leave the room. He literally was sitting in a wheelchair and not leaving the room. And I had a conversation with him, and I was telling him, well, it's time to go, you know, that the book is done, and I don't need any more of your monologues, and he wouldn't go. And he kind of struggled for a while, and then I said, okay, you have like 5 minutes, whatever you have to say, and he said it. He said what he said, I don't want to disclose it, and I jumped, and I couldn't believe that that was the case. And it kind of ties up the whole book, and I didn't know it until I wrote it. So that's the exciting part. So Thank you for listening. Oh, thank you so much for letting me share it, because obviously I can talk about it for hours.
Oh, well, thank you, because I started reading that. I didn't get very far yet, but it has totally hooked me. I mean, it's just fascinating. I personally, I don't know how you do the work that you do, working with criminally insane people that might, you might have to have a guard in the room with you when you're with them and things like that. I think that's that to work with dangerous people like that every day, I don't know how you do it.
So, well, it is very dangerous. We have our own police department, and it's very intense work, and I've worked in the most acute unit. I love it. I love it because the changes are immediate. And I used to be a surgeon before I became a psychiatrist. I used to be a surgeon. Oh. I guess I still have some desire. That's why I really look for very quick changes or radical changes. And this is the field where you have to be very composed, and you gain a lot of skills. And when I started working there, I guess my search, my deep search, was to understand the nature of evil. And that's the philosophy I entered, that whole dimension of forensic psychiatry with. And I worked there for many years now, and I've seen so many cases, high-profile cases of serial killers. I worked with sexually violent predators for years. So all kinds of cases and all kinds of evil, horrible things that people do to each other, to kids. And it's difficult. It's very difficult to deal with that. And that was my transformation, my experience. And I must say that I still did not see the evil per se. I did not see, I mean, there are cases that are horrific. There are cases that are unimaginable. And yet it is part of human nature. It's very sick and ill part of our human nature. But I do believe that it may be healed. And I do believe that there is still, you know, humans behind it. And it teaches you compassion, actually, at the very end, when you can step over your prejudice, because we do have scare prejudice around all the time in different biases. But then it's a different type of compassion to be able to walk into the place where you face your patients who are, you know, carriers of those horrible crimes and say, I'm your doctor. I'm here to heal you. I'm here to help you. I had to teach myself a lot of different things, and compassion first and foremost, to be really, truly, authentically there as their doctor. And I am grateful for that. I learned so much there. So
yes, I think that would just be amazing to work with that. But so you're saying that you concluded that there was not actually evil, that it's just
something in the personality? Well, I didn't conclude it, but so far I have not met anybody who I can say, I mean, there are spiritual presences, but what you touched upon, the so-called possession and the presence of other entities, so to speak, in people, I think this is more interesting than anything for me, because there are human beings, suffering human beings. And when I see somebody who committed horrendous crime, I know that that person is suffering almost as much, not as much, but there is suffering as well. No matter how they appear to you, no matter how they, what they say, but
yes,
it's more the evil is more other presences than just human individual mind. And this is, you know, it's still a lot of questions. It's still continuous work, but I did not meet anybody who was not a human in what they did. So that's what I'm saying.
Oh, I understand, because I have had some experience in dealing with people that were sexually molested as children, and I found that a lot of the healing has to happen when they can come to understand the woundedness of that parent or that person that abused them, when they can actually understand that that person themselves was in pain and caused them to strike out and do the damages they did, only then can they really feel compassion for that person. And
well, it's a great point. I think you're absolutely right. It's about forgiveness. It's not about excuse, but it's about forgiveness, finding forgiveness to be able to move on. But I also think there's a lot of, and when that forgiveness comes in, as you said, exactly right, I think it gives a person tremendous opportunity to turn their pain, their trauma into potentially incredible power. Because this is what I see healing. This is what a lot of shamans go through. A lot of pain is kind of incorporated in the whole initiation process, you know, in traditional cultures. Mm-hmm. And as you know, and working with people, that, you know, when we survive something, that when it doesn't really kill us, it makes us stronger. But when you put specific attention and go for initiation, it makes you actually a person of power, shaman or whatever you practice. It gives you skills and powers and abilities that you wouldn't have before. But you need to know how to transform that. And forgiveness is first step. You're absolutely right. Absolutely.
Yes. What I've seen is that a lot of that didn't happen until they were actually able to wrap their mind around the idea that daddy had been molested himself and was still suffering pain and trauma from his own abuse as a child, and somehow was still acting out things
In some cases, that's exactly correct. There are cases when there was no any history of trauma in the predator. So I wouldn't generalize it, because there may be people listen. Everybody who is listening who has any kind of personal story that relates to that, that's a very personal, unique story. Every personal story is unique. So I wouldn't probably generalize, but you're right. I mean, this is the first step in understanding. And I also believe that it's a Native American tradition. When you do something, it affects seven generations, right, before and after. And I absolutely believe when we perform healing for ourselves, when we go for our transformation, we do accelerate and actually perform healing for generations before us. That's why I said it many times. A lot of times people come to me asking for therapy and ask how, if they have children, how old their children, when I suspect any type of trauma. And a lot of times it's an indication when they experienced that trauma, because when their children reach that age, it's almost unconscious desire to protect the child. They don't think about it, but they start looking for help because they want to protect their child from what happened at their age to them. So it's all connected. And when we heal, we do help our ancestors, and that's another huge area, how we relate to our ancestors. And that's what you said about your father at the beginning, the connection with your father when he appeared to you. I mean, that connection doesn't it's not weakened for your life, right? It's always there. It's probably even stronger right now than ever. Am I right?
Well, no, I've never seen him since then.
Really?
But maybe because you
the connection is not about seeing. But how do you feel about him?
Oh yes, I'm very proud. I actually just a couple of years ago I decided to trace my ancestry back, and when I traced it back through my father, whose last name was Wise, W-I-S-E, that's my maiden name. When I traced it back through his line, I found that. Some of my ancestors were crusaders. They were knights in England. They were part of the three powerhouses there, the Houses of Wise, that were in three different parts of England where they ruled whole sections. But they were descended from Saxons, which came from the Germanic tribes, I guess, the Jutes and the so forth. But anyway, the line is a very powerful, I mean, very powerful warriors and people who reached high standing in their communities, and when they came to the United States, continued to do that. So it made me very proud all of a sudden, because I never knew anybody on his side of the family. He died when I was two. But it made me very proud to be his daughter and to think, oh, wow, you know. This is
and
pretty awesome.
That is amazing story. And well, that explains a lot actually about you and your show. But also, I think it's It is a life resource. This is when I listen to you, I really feel that through you, there's this life connection with all these powerful presences and people who, they're not gone. They're not gone from existence. They're gone from this plane and level, but the connection stays. That's what I mean. And this is so amazing to hear you talking about it and being connected and continuing what you're doing, because we are ambassadors. We are here basically ambassadors in this reality, in this universe, expanding our experience here as life beings, life in this dimension. But then it's not the beginning and it's not the end. It's just a limited existence in this particular spaceship. I call our body a spaceship, and it actually, you know, that's how I see it. And then we travel again, but the connection stays. And when you talk about it, it's really, that's what I sense so strongly, the presence of this in your father, when you saw him, you know, as a little girl. That's the experience you still remember. It's it is amazing, and we all have it. Yeah.
Yes, and the wonderful thing, like you said, we're ambassadors here, and we actually have the chance, the opportunity to break some of the patterns that maybe were not that good. You know, back through our line, we actually in this lifetime have the opportunity to make other choices and break some of those patterns so that our future generations are not still carrying on some of the things that, you know, they would rather not have.
Absolutely. You said it exactly right. It's the free will. I think we have some opportunities in our lifetime that we are not even fully aware of, including how we apply our free will in changing, transforming, and expanding our reality for children, for those who will come after us. Absolutely.
Okay. Olga, we're running out of time, so I have to thank you very much. It's wonderful having you on the show, and I hope you'll join us again sometime in the future. All my listeners, we have Yoti next week. She is the ambassador and spokesman for the 13 grandmothers. So please join me next Friday at 12. May the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.